chief directorate guy. And probably not a pickpocket either. Then what? Foley wondered. He'd have to be patient to find out, but Foley knew a lot about patience. He kept on reading his newspaper. If it were someone who wanted to do a little business, why scare him off? At the very least, he'd let him feel clever. It was always useful to help other people feel smart. That way, they could continue their mistakes. 3 more stops before he got off the subway. Foley had known up front that it would be a lot more productive to ride it than to drive the car. That Mercedes was just too standout-ish for this place. It would make Mary Pat stand out, too, but to her way of thinking, that worked for her rather than against. His wife had brilliant field instincts, better than his, but she often scared him in her daring. It wasn't so much that Mary Pat was a risk-taker. Every member of the DDO took risks. It was her relish for doing so that occasionally worried him. For him, playing with the Russians was part of the job. It was business, as Don Vito Corleone would have put it, not personal. But for Mary Patricia, it was as personal as hell because of her grandfather. She'd lusted to be part of CIA before they'd met in the student union at Fordham, and then again at the CIA recruiter's desk, and they'd hit it off soon after that. She'd already had her Russian language skills. She could pass for a native. She could alter her accent for any region of the country. She could feign being an instructor in poetry at Moscow State University, and she was pretty. And pretty women had an advantage over everyone else. It was the oldest of prejudices that the attractive among us had to be good people, that the bad people had to be ugly because they did ugly things. Men were especially deferential to pretty women. Other women were less so because they envied their looks, but even they were nice by instinct. So Mary Pat could skate on a lot of things because she was just that pretty American girl, that ditzy blonde, because blondes were universally thought to be dumb, even here in Russia, where they were not all that uncommon. The ones here were probably natural blondes, too, because the local cosmetics industry was about as advanced as it must have been in 12th century Hungary, and there wasn't much Clairol Blonde number 100G in the local drugstores. No, the Soviet Union paid scant attention to the needs of its women folk, which led his mind to another question. Why had the Russians stopped at only one revolution? In America, there would have been hell to pay for the lack of choices in clothes and cosmetics the women had here. The train stopped at his station. Foley made his way to the door and walked to the escalator. Halfway up, his curiosity got the better of him. He rubbed his nose as though with a case of the sniffles and fished in his pocket for a handkerchief. He rubbed his nose with it and then shoved it in his coat pocket, which, he discovered, was empty. So what had that been all about? There was no telling. Just one more random event in a life filled with them? But Edward Foley hadn't been trained to think in terms of random events. He'd continue this regular schedule and be sure to catch this same subway train every day for a week or so, just to see if there might be a repeat. Albert Byrd seemed a competent eye-cutter. He was shorter and older than Jack. He had a beard, black and showing hints of gray. A lot of beards in England, she'd noted. And tattoos, more than she'd ever encountered before. Professor Byrd was a skilled clinician, good with his patients, and a very adept surgeon, liked and trusted by his nursing team. Always the sign of a good doc, Kathy knew. He seemed to be a good teacher, but Kathy already knew most of what he had to teach, and knew more about lasers than he did. The argon laser here was new, but not as new as the one at Hopkins, and it would be 2 weeks before they even had a xenon arc laser, for which she was Wilmer Eye Institute's best jockey at Hopkins. The bad news was in the physical facilities. Healthcare in Britain was effectively a government monopoly. Everything was free, and, like everywhere in the world, you got what you paid for. The waiting rooms were far shabbier than Kathy was used to, and she remarked on it.
I know, Professor Bird said tiredly. It's not a priority.
The third case I saw this morning, Mrs. Dover, she'd been on the waiting list for 11 months. For a cataract evaluation that took me 20 minutes. My God, Albert. At home, her family physician just calls my secretary and I see her in 3 or 4 days. I work hard at Hopkins, but not that hard.
What would you charge?
For that?
Oh, $200?
Since I'm an assistant professor at Willmar, I come a little higher than a new resident. But, she didn't add, she was a damn sight smarter than the average resident, more experienced and a faster worker. Mrs. Dover is going to need surgery to correct it, she added.
Want me to do it? Complicated? Bird asked.
She shook her head. Routine procedure. About 90 minutes work because of her age, but it doesn't look as though there should be any complications.
Well, Mrs. Dover, we'll go on the list.
How long?
It's not an emergency procedure. 9 to 10 months, Bird figured.
You're kidding, Kathy objected. That long?
That's about normal.
But that's 9 or 10 months during which she can't see well enough to drive a car.
She won't ever see a bill, Bird pointed out.
Fine. She can't read the newspapers for the best part of a year. Albert, that's awful.
It's our national health care system, Bird explained.
I see, Kathy said.
But she didn't really. The surgeons here were proficient enough, but they did only a bit more than half the procedures she and her colleagues did at Hopkins, and she'd never felt overworked in the Maumini building. Sure, you worked hard, but people needed you, and her job was to restore and improve the sight of people who required expert medical care. And Carolyn Ryan, M.D., FACS, that was a religious calling. It wasn't that the local docs were lazy. It was just that the system allowed, nay, encouraged them to take a very laissez-faire attitude toward their work. She'd arrived in a very new medical world, and it wasn't all that brave. Neither had she seen a CAT scan. They'd essentially been invented in Britain by EMI, but some bean counter in the British government, the Home Office, they'd told her, had decided that the country only needed a few of them, and so most hospitals lost the lottery. The CAT scan had just come into being a few years before she'd entered the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, but in the ensuing decade they'd become as much a part of medicine as the stethoscope. Practically every hospital in America had one. They cost $1 million apiece, but the patient paid for the use of the things, and they paid themselves off quickly enough. She only rarely needed one. To examine tumors around the eye, for example. But when you did, you damned well needed it right now. And at Johns Hopkins, the floors were mopped every day. But the people had the same needs, and she was a doc, and that, Kathy decided, was that. One of her medical school colleagues had gone to Pakistan and come back with the kind of experience in eye pathologies that you couldn't get in a lifetime in American hospitals. Of course, he'd also come back with amoebic dysentery, which was guaranteed to lessen anyone's enthusiasm for foreign travel. At least that wouldn't happen here, she told herself, unless she caught it in a doctor's waiting room.
Chapter 9. Spirits. Thus far, Ryan had not managed to catch the same train home as his wife, always managing to get home later than she did. By the time he got home, he'd be able to think about doing some work on his Halsey book. It was about 70% done, with all the serious research behind him. He just had to finish the writing. What people never seemed to understand was that this was the hard part. Researching was just locating and recording facts.
Making the facts seem to come together in a coherent story was the difficult part, because human lives were never coherent, especially a hard-drinking warrior like William Frederick Halsey, Jr. Writing a biography was more than anything else an exercise in amateur psychiatry. You seized incidents that happened in his life at randomly selected ages and education levels, but you could never know the little key memories that formed a life. The third-grade schoolyard fight, or the admonishment from his maiden Aunt Helen that resonated in his mind for his entire life, because men rarely revealed such things to others. Ryan had such memories, and some of them appeared and disappeared in his consciousness at seemingly random intervals. When the message from Sister Frances Mary in second grade at St. Matthew's School leaped into his memory as though he were 7 years old again. A skilled biographer seemed to have the ability to simulate such things, but it sometimes came down to making things up, to applying your own personal experiences to the life of another person, and that was fiction, and history wasn't supposed to be fiction. Neither was an article in a newspaper, but Ryan knew from his own experience that much purported news was made up from whole cloth. But nobody ever said that writing a biography was easy. His first book, Doomed Eagles, had been, in retrospect, a much easier project. Bill Halsey, Fleet Admiral, USN, had fascinated him since reading the man's own autobiography as a boy. He'd commanded naval forces in battle, and while that had seemed exciting to a boy of 10 years, it was positively frightening to a man of 32, because now he understood the things that Halsey didn't discuss in full. The unknowns. Having to trust intelligence information without really knowing where it came from, how it was gathered, how it was analyzed and processed, how it was transmitted to him, and whether or not the enemy was listening in. Ryan was now in that loop, and having to wager his life on the work that he did himself was frightening as hell. Rather more so, actually, to be wagering the lives of others whom he might or, more likely, might not know. There was a joke he remembered from his time in the Marine Corps, Ryan thought, as the green English countryside slid past his window. The motto of the intelligence services was, "We bet your life." That was now his business. He had to wager the lives of others. Theoretically, he might even come up with an intelligence estimate that risked the fate of his country. You had to be so damned sure of yourself and your data. But you couldn't always be sure, could you? He'd scoffed at many official CIA estimates to which he'd been exposed back at Langley, but it was a damn sight easier to spit on the work of others than it was to produce something better yourself. His Halsey book, tentatively titled Fighting Sailor, would upset a few conventional wisdom apple carts, and deliberately so. Ryan thought that the conventional thinking in some areas was not merely incorrect, but stuff that could not possibly be true. Halsey had acted rightly in some cases where the all-seeing eye of hindsight had castigated him for being wrong. And that was unfair. Halsey could only be judged responsible for the information that was available to him. To say otherwise was like castigating doctors for not being able to cure cancer. They were smart people, doing their best, but there were some things they didn't know yet. They were working like hell to find them out, but the process of discovery took time then, as it was still taking time now, Ryan thought. Was it ever? And Bill Halsey could only know what he was given, or what a reasonably intelligent man might deduce from that information, given a lifetime of experience, and what he knew of the psychology of his enemy. And even then the enemy did not willingly cooperate in his own destruction, did he? That's my job, all right, Ryan thought behind blank eyes. It was a quest for truth, but it was more than that. He had to replicate for his own masters the thinking processes of others, to explain them to his own superiors so that they, Ryan's bosses, could better understand their adversaries. He was playing shrink without a diploma. In a way, that was amusing. It was less so when you considered the magnitude of the task and the potential consequences of failure. It came down to two words. Dead people. In the basic school at Quantico Marine Base, they'd hammered the same lesson home often enough. Screw up leading your platoon, and some of your Marines don't go home to their mothers and wives. And that would be a heavy burden to carry on your conscience for the rest of your life. The profession of arms attached a large price tag to mistakes. Ryan hadn't served long enough to learn that lesson for himself, but it had frightened him on quiet nights, feeling the roll of the ship on her way across the Atlantic. He'd talked it over with Gunny Tate, but the sergeant, then an elderly man of 34, had just told him to remember his training, trust his instincts, and to think before acting if he had the time, and then warned that you didn't always have the luxury of time. And he'd told his young boss not to worry, because he seemed pretty smart for a second lieutenant. Ryan would never forget that. The respect of a Marine gunnery sergeant didn't come cheaply. So he had the brains to make good intelligence estimates and the guts to put his name behind them. But he had to be damned sure they were good stuff before he put them out. Because he was betting the lives of other people, wasn't he? The train slowed to a stop. The escalator was working, and there were a few cabs topside. Jack imagined they had the train schedule memorized. "Good evening, Sir John." Jack saw it was Ed Beaverton, his morning pickup. "Hi, Ed." "You know," Ryan said, getting into the front seat for a change, "better legroom." "My name is actually Jack."
"I can't call you that," Beaverton objected. "You're a knight."
"Only honorary. Not a real one. I do not own a sword." "Well, only my Marine Corps one, and that's back home in the States."
"And you were a lieutenant, and I was only a corporal."
"And you jumped out of airplanes.
Damned if I ever did anything that stupid, Eddie."
"Only 28 times. Never broke anything," the taxi driver reported, turning up the hill.
"Not even an ankle?"
"Oh, just a sprain or two.
The boots help with that, you see," the cabbie explained.
"I haven't learned to like flying yet. Damned sure I'll never jump out of an airplane." No, Jack was sure he never would have opted for force recon. Those Marines just weren't wired right. He'd learned the hard way that flying over the beach in helicopters was scary enough. He still had dreams about it. The sudden sensation of falling and seeing the ground rush up. But he always woke up just before impact, usually lurching up to a sitting position in the bed and then looking around the darkened bedroom to make sure he wasn't in that damned CH-46 with a bad aft rotor falling to the rocks on Crete. It was a miracle that he and a lot of his Marines hadn't been killed. But his had been the only major injury. The rest of his platoon had gotten away with nothing worse than sprains. "Why the hell are you thinking about that?" he demanded of himself. It was more than 8 years in his past. They were pulling up in front of the house in Grisdale Close.
"Here we are, sir."
Ryan handed him his fare, plus a friendly tip. "The name's Jack, Eddie."
"Yes, sir.
I'll see you in the morning."
"Roger that."
Ryan walked off, knowing he'd never win that battle. The front door was unlocked in anticipation of his arrival. His tie went first as he headed to the kitchen.
"Daddy!"
Sally fairly screamed as she ran to his arms. Jack scooped her up and gave and got a hug.
"How's my big girl?"
"Fine."
Kathy was at the stove, fixing dinner. He set Sally down and headed to his wife for a kiss.
"How is it," her husband asked, "that you're always home first? At home, you're usually later."
"Unions," she replied.
"Everybody clocks out on time here, and on time is usually pretty early. Not like Hopkins. Where," she didn't add, "just about everyone on the professional staff worked late.
Must be nice to work banker's hours."
"Even Dad doesn't leave his office this early, but everybody over here does.
and lunch means a full hour, half the time away from the hospital.
Well, she allowed, the food's a little better that way.
What's for dinner?
Spaghetti.
And Jack saw that the pot was full of her special meat sauce. He turned to see a baguette of French bread on the counter.
Where's the little guy?
Living room.
Okay. Ryan headed that way. Little Jack was in his crib. He'd just mastered sitting up. It was a little early for that, but that was fine with his dad. Around him was a collection of toys, all of which found their way into his mouth. He looked up to see his father and managed a toothless smile. Of course, that merited a pickup, which Jack accomplished. His diaper felt dry and fresh. Doubtless, Miss Margaret had changed him before scooting off. As always, before Jack made it home from the shop. She was working out fairly well. Sally liked her, and that was the important part. He set his son back down, and the little guy resumed playing with a plastic rattle and watching the TV, especially the commercials. Jack went off to the bedroom to change into more comfortable clothes, then back to the kitchen. Then the doorbell chimed, much to everyone's surprise. Jack went to answer it.
"Dr. Ryan?" the voice asked in American English.
It was a guy of Ryan's height and general looks, dressed in a jacket and tie, holding a large box.
"That's right.
I got your STU for you, sir. I work comms at the embassy," the guy explained. "Mr. Murray said I should bring this right over."
The box was a cardboard cube about 2.5 feet on a side, and blank, with no printing on it. Ryan let the man into the house and led him directly to his den. It took about 3 minutes to extract the oversized phone from the box. It went next to Jack's Apple IIe computer.
"You're NSA?" Ryan asked.
"Yes, sir. Civilian. Used to be in the Army Security Agency, E5. Got out and got a pay increase as a civilian. Been over here 2 years. Anyway, here's your encryption key." He handed over the plastic device.
"You know how these things work, right?"
"Oh, yeah," Ryan nodded. "Got one on my desk downtown."
"So you know the rules about this.
If anything breaks, you call me." He handed over his card. "And nobody but me or one of my people is allowed to look at the inside. If that happens, the system self-destructs, of course. Won't start a fire or anything, but it does stink some because of the plastic. Anyway, that's it." He broke down the box.
"You want a Coke or anything?"
"No, thanks. Gotta get home." And with that, the communications expert walked back out the door to his car.
"What was that, Jack?" Kathy asked from the kitchen.
"My secure phone," Jack explained, returning to his wife's side.
"What's that for?"
"So I can call home and talk to my boss."
"Can't you do that from the office?"
"There's the time difference, and, well, there are some things I can't talk about there."
"Secret agent stuff," she snorted.
"That's right. Just like the pistol he had in his closet." Kathy accepted the presence of his Remington shotgun with some equanimity. He used it for hunting, and she was prepared to tolerate that, since you could cook and eat the birds, and the shotgun was unloaded. But she was less comfortable with a pistol. And so, like civilized, married people, they didn't talk about it, so long as it was well out of Sally's reach, and Sally knew that her father's closet was off-limits. Ryan had gotten fond of his Browning high-power 9mm automatic, which was loaded with 14 Federal hollow-point cartridges and 2 spare magazines, plus tritium match sights and custom-made grips. If he ever needed a pistol again, this would be the one. He'd have to find a place to practice shooting, Ryan reminded himself. Maybe the nearby Royal Navy base had a range. Sir Basil could probably make a phone call and straighten it out. As an honorary knight, he didn't own a sword, but a pistol was the modern equivalent, and it could be a useful tool on occasion. So could a corkscrew.
"Chianti?" Ryan asked.
Kathy turned.
"Okay. I don't have anything scheduled for tomorrow.
Kath, I've never understood what a glass or two of wine tonight would have to do with surgery tomorrow. It's 10 or 12 hours away.
Jack, you don't mix alcohol with surgery, she explained patiently.
Okay?
You don't drink and drive. You don't drink and cut, either. Not ever. Not once.
Yes, doctor.
So tomorrow you just set glasses prescriptions for people?
Uh-huh. Simple day.
How about you?
Nothing important. Same crap, different day.
I don't know how you stand it.
Well, it's interesting secret crap, and you have to be a spook to understand it.
Right. She poured the spaghetti sauce into a bowl.
Here.
I haven't got the wine open yet.
So work faster.
Yes, Professor the Lady Ryan, Jack responded, taking the bowl of sauce and setting it on the table. Then he pulled the cork out of the Chianti. Sally was too big a girl for a high chair, but still small enough for a booster seat, which she carried to the chair herself. Since the dinner was pischetti, her father tucked the cloth napkin into her collar. The sauce would probably get to her pants anyway, but it would teach his little girl about napkins, and that, Kathy thought, was important. Then Ryan poured the wine. Sally didn't ask for any. Her father had indulged her once, over his wife's objections, and that had ended that. Sally got some Coca-Cola.
Svetlana was asleep, finally. She liked to stay up as long as she could, every night the same, or so it seemed, until she finally put her head down. She slept with a smile, her father saw, like a little angel, the sort that decorated Italian cathedrals in the travel books he used to read. The TV was on. Some World War II movie, it sounded like. They were all the same. The Germans attacked cruelly. Well, occasionally there was a German character with something akin to humanity. Usually a German communist, it would be revealed along the way, torn by conflicting loyalties to his class, working class, of course, and his country. And the Soviets resisted bravely, losing a lot of defiant men at first until turning the tide, usually outside Moscow in December 1941, at Stalingrad in January 1943, or the Kursk Bulge in the summer of 1943. There was always a heroic political officer, a courageous private soldier, a wise old sergeant, and a bright young junior officer. Toss in a grizzled general who wept quietly and alone for his men, then had to set his feelings aside and get the job done. There were about 5 different formulas, all of them variations on the same theme, and the only real difference was whether Stalin was seen as a wise, godlike ruler or simply wasn't mentioned at all. That depended on when the film had been shot. Stalin had fallen out of fashion in the Soviet film industry about 1956, soon after Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev had made his famous but then secret speech, revealing what a monster Stalin had been. Something Soviet citizens still had trouble with, especially the cab drivers, or so it seemed. Truth in his country was a rare commodity, and almost always one hard to swallow. But Zaitsev wasn't watching the movie now. Oleg Ivanovich sipped at his vodka, eyes focused on the TV screen without seeing it. It had just struck him how huge a step he'd taken that afternoon on the metro. At the time, it had almost been a lark, like a child playing a prank, reaching into that American's pocket like a sneak thief just to see if he could do it. No one had noticed. He'd been clever and careful about it, and even the American hadn't noticed, or else he would have reacted. So he'd just proven that he had the ability to... What?
To do what? Oleg Ivanovich asked himself with surprising intensity. What the hell had he done on the metro coach? What had he been thinking about? Actually, he hadn't really thought about it at all. It had just been some sort of foolish impulse.
Hadn't it?
He shook his head and took another sip of his drink. He was a man of intelligence. He had a university degree. He was an excellent chess player. He had a job that required the highest security clearance, that paid well, and that had just put him at the bottom entry level of the nomenclatura. He was a person of importance. Not much, but some. The KGB trusted him with knowledge about many things. The KGB had confidence in him. But what, he asked himself. What came after the but part? His mind was wandering in directions he didn't understand and could barely see. The priest. It came down to that, didn't it? Or did it? What was he thinking? Zaitsev asked himself. He didn't really know if he were thinking anything at all. It was as though his hand had developed a mind of its own, taking action without the brain's or the mind's permission, leading off in a direction that he didn't understand. Yes, it had to be that damned priest. Was he bewitched? Was some outside force taking control of his body? No, that was not possible, Zaitsev told himself. That was something from ancient tales, the sort of thing old women discussed, prattled about over a boiling pot. But why, then, had I put my hand in the American's pocket, his mind demanded of itself, but there was no immediate answer. Do you want to be a part of murder? Some small voice asked. Are you willing to facilitate the murder of an innocent man? Was he innocent? Zaitsev asked himself, taking another swallow. Not a single dispatch crossing his desk suggested otherwise. In fact, he could hardly remember any mention of this Father Carroll in any KGB messages during the past couple years. Yes, they'd taken note of his trip back to Poland soon after being elected pope, what man didn't go home after his promotion to see his friends and seek their approval of his new place in the world? The party was made up of men, too, and men made mistakes. He saw them every day, even from the skilled, highly trained officers of KGB who were punished or chided or just remarked upon by their superiors in the center. Leonid Ilyich made mistakes. People chuckled about them over lunch often enough, or talked more quietly about the things his greedy children did, especially his daughter. Hers was a petty corruption, and while people talked about it, they usually spoke quietly. But he was thinking about a much larger and more dangerous kind of corruption. Where did the legitimacy of the state come from? In the abstract, it came from the people, but the people had no say in things. The party did, but only a small minority of the people were in the party, and of those, only a much smaller minority achieved anything resembling power. And so the legitimacy of his state resided atop what was, by any logical measure, a fiction. And that was a very big thought. Other countries were ruled by dictators, often fascists on the political right. Fewer countries were ruled by people on the political left. Hitler represented the most powerful and dangerous of the former, but he'd been overthrown by the Soviet Union and Stalin on one side, and by the Western states on the other. The two most unlikely of allies had combined to destroy the German threat. And who were they? They claimed to be democracies, and while that claim was consistently denigrated by his own country, the elections held in those countries were real. They had to be, since his country and his agency, the KGB, spent time and money trying to influence them. And so there, the will of the people had some reality to it, or else why would KGB try to affect it? Exactly how much? Zaitsev didn't know.
There was no telling from the information available in his own country, and he didn't bother listening to the voice of America and other obvious propaganda arms of the Western nations. So, it wasn't the people who wanted to kill the priest. It was Andropov, certainly, and the Politburo, possibly, who wished to do it. Even his workmates at the center had no particular bone to pick with Father Carroll. There was no talk of his enmity to the Soviet Union. The state TV and radio had not called out for class hatred against him, as they did for other foreign enemies. There had been no pejorative articles about him in Pravda that he'd seen of late. Just some rumbles about the labor problems in Poland, and those were not overly loud, more the sort of thing a neighbor might say about a misbehaving child next door. But that's what it had to be all about. Carol was Polish, and a source of pride for the people there, and Poland was politically troubled because of labor disputes. Carol wanted to use his political or spiritual power to protect his people. That was understandable, wasn't it? But was killing him understandable? Who would stand up and say, "No, you cannot kill this man because you dislike his politics"? The Politburo? No. They'd go along with Andropov. He was the heir apparent. When Leonid Ilyich died, he'd be the one to take his chair at the head of the table. Another party man. Well, what else could he be? The party was the soul of the people, so the saying went. That was about the only mention of soul the party permitted. Did some part of a man live on after death? That was what the soul was supposed to be, but here the party was the soul, and the party was a thing of men, and little more. And corrupt men at that. And they wanted to kill a priest. He'd seen the dispatches. In a very small way, he, Oleg Ivanovich Zaitsev, was helping. And that was eating at something inside him. A conscience? Was he supposed to have one of those? But a conscience was something that measured one set of facts or ideas against another and was either content or not. If not, if it found some action at fault, then the conscience started complaining. It whispered. It forced him to look and keep looking until the issue was resolved, until the wrong action was stopped or reversed or atoned for. But how did you stop the party or the KGB from doing something? To do that, Zaitsev knew, you had at the very least to demonstrate that the proposed action was contrary to political theory or would have adverse political consequences, because politics was the measure of right and wrong. But wasn't politics too fleeting for that? Didn't right and wrong have to depend on something more solid than mere politics? Wasn't there some higher value system? Politics was just tactics after all, wasn't it? And while tactics were important, strategy was more so. Because strategy was the measure of what you used tactics for, and strategy in this case was supposed to be what was right. Transcendentally right. Not just right at the moment, but right for all times. Something historians could examine in 100 or 1,000 years and pronounce as correct action. Did the party think in such terms? How exactly did the Communist Party of the Soviet Union make its decisions? What was good for the people? But who measured that? Individuals did. Brezhnev, Andropov, Suslov, the rest of the full voting members of the Politburo, advised by the non-voting candidate members, further advised by the Council of Ministers and the members of the Central Committee of the Party, all the senior members of the Nomenklatura, the ones to whom the resident in Paris shipped perfume and pantyhose in the diplomatic bag. Zaitsev had seen enough of those dispatches, and he'd heard the stories. Those were the ones who lavished presents and status upon their children, the ones who raced down the center lane of the broad Moscow boulevards, the corrupt Marxist princes who ruled his country with hands of iron. Did those princes think in terms of what was good for the Narod? The masses, as they were called, the numberless workers and peasants whom they ruled, for whose good they supposedly looked after? But probably the minor princes under Nikolai Romanov had thought and spoken the same way, and Lenin had ordered them all shot as enemies of the people. As modern movies spoke of the Great Patriotic War, so earlier movies had portrayed them for less sophisticated audiences as evil buffoons, hardly serious enemies, easily hated and easily killed. Caricatures of real people who were all so different from those men who'd replaced them, of course. As the princes of old had driven their troika-harnessed sleds over the very bodies of the peasants on their way to the royal court, so today the officers of the Moscow militia kept the center lane open for the new nomenklatura members who didn't have time for traffic delays. Nothing had really changed. Except that the czars of old had at least paid lip service to a higher authority. They'd financed St. Basil's Cathedral here in Moscow, and other noblemen had financed countless other churches in lesser cities, because even the Romanovs had acknowledged a power higher than theirs. But the party acknowledged no higher order. And so it could kill without regret, because killing was often a political necessity, a tactical advantage to be undertaken when and where convenient. Was that all this was? Zaitsev asked himself. Were they killing the Pope just because it was more convenient? Oleg Ivanich poured himself another portion of vodka from the nearby bottle and took another swallow. There were many inconveniences in his life. It was too long a walk from his desk to the water cooler. There were people at work whom he didn't like. Stefan Yevgenievich Ivanov, for example, a more senior major in communications. How he'd managed to get promoted 4 years ago was a mystery to everyone in the section. He was disregarded by the more senior people as a drone who was unable to do any useful work. Zaitsev supposed every business had one such person, an embarrassment to the office, but not easily removed because he was just there, and that was all there was to it. Were Ivanov out of the way, Oleg could be promoted, if not in rank, then in status, to chief of the section. Every single breath Ivanov took was an inconvenience to Oleg Ivanich, but that didn't give him the right to kill the more senior communicator, did it? No. He'd be arrested and prosecuted, and perhaps even executed for murder. Because it was forbidden by law. Because it was wrong. The law, the party, and his own conscience told him that. But Andropov wanted to kill Father Kirill, and his conscience didn't say nay. Would some other conscience do so? Another swallow of vodka. Another snort. A conscience on the Politburo. Even in the KGB there were no ruminations, no debates, no open discussion, just action messages and notices of completion or failure. Evaluations of foreigners, of course. Discussions of the thinking of foreigners, real agents or mere agents of influence, called useful fools in the KGB lexicon.
Never had a field officer written back about an order and said, "No, comrade, we ought not to do that, because it would be morally wrong." Godorenko in Rome had come closest, posing the observation that killing Carol might have adverse consequences on operations. Did that mean that Ruslan Borisovich had a troubled conscience as well? No. Godorenko had three sons, one in the Soviet Navy, another he'd heard at the KGB's own academy out on the Ring Road, and the third in Moscow State University. If Ruslan Borisovich had any difficulties with the KGB, any action could mean, if not death, then at least serious embarrassment for his children. And few men took action like that. So, was his the only conscience in KGB? Zaitsev took a swallow to ponder that one. Probably not. There were thousands of men in the center and thousands more elsewhere, and just the laws of statistics made it likely that there were plenty of good men, however one defined that. But how did one identify them? It was certain death or lengthy imprisonment to try to go looking for them. That was the baseline problem he had. There was no one in whom he could confide his doubts, no one with whom he could discuss his worries. Not a doctor, not a priest, not even his wife, Irina. No, he had only his vodka bottle, and though it helped him think, after a fashion, it wasn't much of a companion. Russian men were not averse to shedding tears, but they wouldn't have helped either. Irina might ask a question, and he wouldn't be able to answer to anyone's satisfaction. All he had was sleep. It would not help, he was sure, and in this he was right. Another hour and two more slugs of the vodka at last drugged him into sleepiness. His wife was dozing in front of the TV. The Red Army had won the Battle of Kursk again, and the movie ended at the beginning of a long march that would lead to the Reichstag in Berlin, full of hope and enthusiasm for the bloody task. Zaitsev chuckled to himself. It was more than he had at the moment. He carried his empty glass to the kitchen, then roused his wife for the trip to the bedroom. He hoped that sleep would come quickly. The quarter liter of alcohol in his belly should help. And so it did. "You know, Arthur, there are a lot of things we don't know about him," Jim Greer said. "Andropov, you mean?" "We don't even know if the bastard's married," the DDI continued. "Well, Robert, that's your department," the DCI observed with a look at Bob Ritter. "We think he is, but he's never brought his wife, if any, to an official function." "That's usually how we find out," the DDO had to admit. "They often hide their families, like mafia dons. They are so anal about hiding everything over there. And yeah, we're not all that good at digging the information up because it's not operationally important." "How he treats his wife and kids, if any," Greer pointed out, "can be useful in profiling the guy." "So you want me to task Cardinal on something like that?" "He could do it, I'm sure, but why waste his time that way?" "Is it a waste? If he's a wife-beater, it tells us something. If he's a doting father, it tells us something else," the DDI persisted. "He's a thug. You can look at his photo and see that. Look how his staff acts around him. They're stiff, like you'd have expected from Hitler's staff," Ritter responded. A few months before, a gaggle of American state governors had flown to Moscow for some sub-Rosa diplomacy. The governor of Maryland, a liberal Democrat, had reported back that when Andropov had entered the reception room, he'd spotted him at once as a thug, then learned that it was Yuri Vladimirovich, chairman of the Committee for State Security. The Marylander had possessed a good eye for reading people, and that evaluation had gone into the Andropov file at Langley. "Well, he wouldn't have been much of a judge," Arthur Moore observed. He'd read the file, too. "At least not at the appeals level. Too interested in hanging the poor son of a bitch just to see if the rope breaks or not. Not that Texas hadn't had a few judges like that once upon a time, but it was much more civilized now. There were fewer horses that needed stealing than men who needed killing, after all. Okay, Robin, what can we do to flesh him out a little? Looks like he's going to be their next general secretary, after all. Strikes me as a good idea. I can rattle some cages. Why not ask Sir Basil what he can do? They're better at the social stuff than we are, and it takes the heat off our people. I like Baz, but I don't like having him hold that many markers for us, Judge Moore answered. Well, James, your protege is over there. Have him ask the question. You get him an STU at home yet? Ought to have gotten there today, yes. So call your lad and have him ask, nice and casual-like. Greer's eyes went to the judge. Arthur? Approved. Lowercase this, though. Tell Ryan that it's for his personal interests, not ours. The admiral checked his watch. Okay, I can do that before I head home. Now, Bob, any progress on Mask of the Red Death? The DCI asked with amusement, just to close down the afternoon meeting. It was a fun idea, but not a very serious one. Arthur, let's not discount it too much, shall we? They are vulnerable to the right sort of bullet once we load it in the gun. Don't talk that way in front of Congress. They might foul their panties, Greer warned with a laugh. We're supposed to enjoy peaceful coexistence with them. That didn't work very well with Hitler. Stalin and Chamberlain both tried to make nice with a son of a bitch. Where did it get them? They are our enemies, gentlemen, and the sad truth is that we can't have real peace with them, like it or not. Their ideas and ours are too out of sync for that. He held up his hands. Yeah, I know we're not supposed to think that way, but thank God the president does, and we still work for him. They didn't have to comment on that. All three had voted for the current president, despite the institutional joke that the two things one never found at Langley were communists and Republicans. No, the new president had a little iron in his spine and a fox's instinct for opportunity. It especially appealed to Ritter, who was the cowboy of the three, if also the most abrasive. Okay, I have some budget work to do for that hearing with the Senate day after tomorrow, Moore announced, breaking up the meeting. Ryan was at his computer, thinking over the Battle of Leyte Gulf, when the phone rang. It was the first time for it, with its oddly trilling ringer. He reached in his pocket for the plastic key, slid it into the appropriate slot, then lifted the receiver. Stand by, a mechanical voice said. Synchronizing the line. Stand by, synchronizing the line. Stand by, synchronizing the line. Line is secure, it said at last. Hello, Ryan said, wondering who had an STU and would call him this late. It turned out to be the obvious answer. Hi, Jack, a familiar voice greeted him. One nice thing about the STU, the digital technology made voices as clear as if the speaker were sitting in the room. Ryan checked the desk clock. Kind of late there, sir. Not as late as in jolly old England. How's the family? Mainly asleep at the moment. Kathy is probably reading a medical journal, which was what she did instead of watching TV anyway. What can I do for you, Admiral? I have a little job for you. Okay, Ryan responded. Ask around, casual-like, about Yuri Andropov. There are a few things about him we don't know. Maybe Basil has the information we want. What exactly, sir? Jack asked. Is he married, and does he have any kids? We don't know if he's married? Ryan realized that he hadn't seen that information in the dossier, but
he'd assumed it was elsewhere and had taken no particular note of it.
That's right. The judge wants to see if Basil might know.
Okay, I can ask Simon. How important is this?
Like I said, casual-like, like it's your own interest. Then call me back from there. Your home, I mean.
Will do, sir.
We know his age, birthday, education and stuff, but not if he's married or has any kids, huh? That's how it works sometimes.
Yes, sir.
And that got Jack thinking. They knew everything about Brezhnev but his dick size. They did know his daughter's dress size, 12, which someone had thought important enough to get from the Belgian milliner who'd sold the silken wedding dress to her doting father through the ambassador. But they didn't know if the likely next general secretary of the Soviet Union was married.
Christ, the guy was pushing 60 and they didn't know?
What the hell? Okay, I can ask. That ought not to be too hard. Otherwise, how's London?
I like it here, and so does Kathy, but she's a little dubious about their state medical care system.
Socialized medicine? I don't blame her. I still get everything done at Bethesda. But it helps a little that I have Admiral in front of my name. It's not quite as fast for a retired chief bosun's mate.
I bet.
In Ryan's case, it helped a whole lot that his wife was on the faculty at Johns Hopkins. He didn't talk to anyone in a lab coat without professor on his name tag, and he'd learned that in the field of medicine, the really smart ones were the teachers, unlike the rest of society.
The dreams came after midnight, though he had no way of knowing that.
It was a clear Moscow summer day, and a man in white was walking across the Red Square. St. Basil's Cathedral was behind him, and he was walking against the traffic past Lenin's mausoleum. Some children were with him, and he was talking to them in a kindly way, as a favored uncle might. Or perhaps a parish priest. Then Oleg knew that's what he was, a parish priest. But why in white? With gold brocade, even. The children, 4 or 5 each of boys and girls, were holding his hands and looking up at him with innocent smiles. Then Oleg turned his head. Up at the top of the tomb, where they stood for the May Day parades, were the Politburo members. Brezhnev, Suslov, Ustinov, and Andropov. Andropov was holding a rifle and pointing at the little procession. There were other people around, faceless people walking aimlessly, going about their business. Then Oleg was standing with Andropov, listening to his words. He was arguing for the right to shoot the man.
"Be careful of the children, Yuri Vladimirovich," Suslov warned.
"Yes, be careful," Brezhnev agreed.
Ustinov reached over to adjust the sights on the rifle. They all ignored Zaitsev, who moved among them, trying to get their attention.
"But why?" Zaitsev asked. "Why are you doing this?"
"Who is this?" Brezhnev asked Andropov.
"Never mind him," Suslov snarled. "Just shoot the bastard."
"Very well," Andropov said.
He took his aim carefully, and Zaitsev was unable to intervene, despite being right there. Then the chairman squeezed the trigger. Zaitsev was back on the street now. The first bullet struck a child, a boy on the priest's right, who fell without a sound.
"Not him, you idiot! The priest!"
Mikhail Suslov screamed like a rabid dog. Andropov shot again, this time hitting a little blonde girl standing at the priest's left. Her head exploded in red. Zaitsev bent down to help her, but she said it was all right, and so he left her and returned to the priest.
"Look out, why don't you?"
"Look out for what, my young comrade?" the priest asked pleasantly. Then he turned.
"Come, children. We're off to see God."
Andropov fired again.
This time the bullet struck the priest square in the chest. There was a splash of blood about the size and color of a rose. The priest grimaced, but kept going, with the smiling children in tow. Another shot, another rose on the chest, to the left of the first. But still, he kept going, walking slowly.
"Are you hurt?" Zaitsev asked.
"It is nothing," the priest replied. "But why didn't you stop him?"
"But I tried," Zaitsev insisted.